Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as the Senate debates the bank reform bill, the issue has taken on yet a whole new sense of urgency since Friday when the Securities and Exchange Commission sued Goldman Sachs for fraud in connection with a sale of some housing market-related bonds. Allegedly, the company did not tell investors that one of the designers of the fund was a man named John Paulson, whose market strategy was to bet against such portfolios. In other words, he was betting on a housing crash. He got it right, by the way, and made $1 billion. But did Goldman defraud its customers? And is this incident now the emblem of how Wall Street greed caused suffering for us all? Joining me first on this is Fawn Johnson, Wall Street Journal reporter. Fawn, thanks very much for coming on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. And also walking into our studio right now and making himself comfortable is Robin Farzad, senior writer for Business Week, who coincidentally had a long cover story on Goldman Sachs last week, just before this happened. Robin, thanks a lot for coming into our studio today.
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure.
This is complicated stuff, first of all, for people who don't work in finance. So take a minute, and Robin, you can start, to explain not just what is alleged here, but why people are saying this could be the signature court case for the whole financial and housing meltdown.
Brian, because it seems to have the cynicism of the entire alleged Wall Street cabal writ small on one deal, that you brought in this hedge fund manager and you effectively, as Goldman Sachs, orchestrated one of the wealthiest men in America versus subprime. A trade that was only enabled by hundreds of thousands of Americans potentially defaulting on their mortgages. And Goldman is saying that we were only a market maker. We were only enabling a client, no more, no less. And yet it looks as though they went, maybe according to the SEC, a step or two past that mandate.
But Fawn, take me past that, and we will get into the weeds of this case in a minute. It's fascinating even for people who don't know beans about the bean counters on Wall Street. But why do you think this, because it's a relatively small case as these things go, or as the whole economy, in comparison to the whole economy, why do you think this is being seen as the signature court case for the whole financial and housing meltdown already?
Well, let's not forget that the recipient of this complaint is Goldman Sachs, which has been under some public scrutiny, in part for taking government bailout funds a year or so ago, and also for quite publicly paying its executives quite large bonuses. This is not popular on the public relations front. So just to start, the SEC is going after a big dog here. And that is significant from the standpoint of the SEC, which is coming off of some failures, the most notorious, of course, being Bernie Madoff and this failure to detect the Ponzi scheme. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that this is really the first case brought by the feds that is looking at these complex instruments coming out of the cause of the financial meltdown, some would say, and coming out of the entire meltdown itself. There have been others they have brought that are slightly lower profile, but this is the first big deal where they're actually going to be asking questions about what the market makers were doing back in 2007, 2008, when this entire system turned on its head.
And Robin, maybe I've been reading the Wall Street Journal editorial page too much over the last few days, but they asked this morning, and I think it's a good question, if this is supposed to represent Wall Street trashing the economy for the rest of us, is that all there is? That's their question. Is that all there is? Fraud in one trading group of about $1 billion, where those defrauded were mostly a few very sophisticated European bankers. Is that all there is?
Well, it's a paradox that you speak to. Look, to Fawn's point, they didn't, I think it's important here from the outside world's perspective and the press's perspective, the SEC coming off really such a humbling of the past 5 years didn't opt for just a little buckshot or an air rifle that you buy from Walmart. I mean, they brought out the howitzer. They went after the big one. I mean, the one that has the most polemic appeal, the one that's been pilloried in the pages of Rolling Stone magazine even. I mean, Michael Moore was inveighing against Goldman Sachs. So I think there's a good measure of signaling, even if this case is going to be vexingly hard to kind of peg an element of fraud to in the end. It's more Robert Khuzami at the SEC and a weakened SEC with a chip on his shoulder saying that we're going after the big guys, so the rest of you guys must be forthcoming.
So let's look at what's in this case. It really is fascinating. And listeners, if we have any Goldman employees, if we have any securities lawyers, anyone else who thinks you have some, you know, real inside knowledge and perspective to add for the rest of our listeners, give us a call. We would really appreciate your voices on this. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for our guests from Business Weekend, The Wall Street Journal, or you can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. So, Fawn, here's a very specific question that the Goldman defense is already raising. Do they need to represent who's on the other side of a trade? Did they even need to tell these banks and you know others who may have been buying these portfolios that John Paulson was involved in drawing it up?
That will be the key question. Should this ever go to any kind of judge or a jury or a trial? Is to what Goldman really needs to tell its investors? And I don't know that that's a question that the courts have weighed in on these types of transactions per se. So, you know, obviously they've looked at it in the past with other kinds of financial instruments, but this one is a little bit different because as Goldman has already said, these are sophisticated investors. They should understand when they're investing in a synthesized, collateralized debt obligation, which is a fancy word for saying a big derivative, that you would expect that there are people who are on the other side betting against it. I think that the place where the SEC has a really good sticking point here is what Goldman did not disclose was that the same person who put together the instrument that investors were buying was also betting against it. And that will be a question that's going to reverberate throughout the entire courts and public relations throughout this.
And part of Goldman's response to that is that they never represented to ACA or others involved that Paulson would be long on the bonds. So therefore,
right,
Goldman
exactly.
says there's no fraud. We never said this guy's betting on these things to make money. We didn't tell you that he's betting on them to lose money. But we never said John Paulson's going long on these stocks, on these instruments.
Yeah. And I think, again, this is one of those questions that we haven't really seen debated in the public policy arena yet. So it's a question that, I mean, I'm curious to see how policymakers will look at that and say, well, what really is your disclosure obligation? Is it actually, does it matter, really? Is the real question. And Goldman will say, it doesn't matter. That's not important to what this instrument is. But then I think the SEC has a perfectly legitimate response coming back and saying, well, absolutely, it does matter. And these investors do need to know all the specifics, you know, or at least some of the major specifics that are coming through. And I think this is a pretty major one.
Robin, as far as you know, were all the bonds in this portfolio picked by John Paulson? Did ACA choose from a list that he provided? I mean, we know that ACA chose from a list that he provided, but were they the only bonds? Because I think that's another relevant fact in this case.
And sadly and frustratingly, it's not like I can just pull up Yahoo Finance or go to my Bloomberg terminal and find out who had their fingerprints on what. The special sauce here is the opacity of it, the fact that you could cover your tracks. And strikingly, you know, what's a huge part of Goldman's defense is this diffusion of responsibility, not just that we were dealing with big boy sophisticated investors, but, oh, we brought in an independent third party to look at these bonds. You know, Paulson's statement himself coming out is saying that, you know, they were helping to structure these things. Who knows what happened in the back and forth? When I pressed management on the issue, there was kind of a, you know, prevarication. Well, you know, there was a significant amount of back and forth and vetting and this and that. And to me, it still smacks of what everybody was saying about the ratings agencies 2-3 years ago, subcontracting a fiduciary responsibility, I mean, amidst multiple principal agent conflicts, ultimately is not something that is going to be very satisfying to regulators in this case. But again, you do see Goldman Sachs, not just in the case of ACA, but in the case of, four of the five of the other parts of the bill of particulars saying that, well, we were counting on this party, or it wasn't our fault, but look at these guys.
Robin Farzad from Business Week, Fawn Johnson from The Wall Street Journal, as we talk about the fraud charge against Goldman, and we will get into its implications for the bank reform bill, which may come to the Senate floor this week. Our board is full of callers who have worked on Wall Street and who haven't. Let's talk to Andrew in Highlands, a former securities trader. Andrew, thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, no problems, Brian. I'm really glad that you're bringing this subject to light. I used to be a broker years ago back in the 90s, and when we first had our adjustment in 97, I left the market because I just felt that it was full of a bunch of unsavory individuals that I no longer wanted to work with nor want to associate with. I wouldn't say that my next profession, which is what I've been doing, real estate for 12 years, has been fun. I think that people have to realize that Goldman will most likely just get a slap on the wrist, caveat emptor, buyer beware, and also most of these people who are making these large investments know what's at risk. So I don't really think anyone here is to blame but those who are the regulators that have been blindsided by political awe or by whatever their personal means and dreams are.
Robin, what's your take on that?
I say that, you know, take that with a huge grain of sugar, if you will, in this case, because it's one thing to be cynicized to it after the Chris Cox SEC and after the Donaldson SEC, some of the kind of the lame duck administrations during the Bush two terms, where you could largely expect just some sort of slap on the wrist or sanctioning, and these firms would go on to business as usual. Again, you have an SEC now with a chip on its shoulder, and two, more so than ever, Goldman Sachs and its remaining rivals on Wall Street, they eat what they kill. And it's not like they churn out an indispensable product. It's very fungible. If Goldman Sachs staff leaves to J.P. Morgan, to Morgan Stanley, if prime brokerage clients opt to leave because they would chafe at this kind of scrutiny that somebody that was uber rarefied, such as John Paulson, is suddenly getting for a trade in early 2007, suddenly Goldman Sachs' franchise is significantly weakened. There's taint suddenly accorded to a name that has always been one of the more peerless houses on Wall Street.
But no charges have been proven against them yet. But does this show us, Fawn, to the caller's point, a way in which the banks were perhaps not properly regulated?
Well, I think that the entire reason why the SEC is bringing this case is precisely to make that point. And I think that's been, in Washington, that's been the goal of the regulators and and Congress to try and get the banks to wake up, get Wall Street to wake up and realize that they need the buzzword in Washington is transparency. We want to know what you're trading. We want to know who the players are. We want to know who the counterparties are, and we want to bring some of these trades that have taken place kind of under the cover of darkness out into the bright sunlight. And this case is a perfect example of that. And you know, I think Goldman will be able to probably argue very sophisticatedly that there's no need for that, and that you know some of the trades need to be kept secret for the sake of the markets, and that's the kind of argument that we see all over the place. But in Washington, that's really the point here, and this is the reason why this is a flagship case, because people are going to watch this and they're going to be asking questions about disclosure. And you know, it's true that the investors are sophisticated, but I think that the point of view from the government and the administration here is they're not as sophisticated as everyone thinks they are. Mm. And we all want to find out what happened.
Does the reform before the Senate now address this issue, Fawn?
Well, the one place where it does address it in broad strokes. Now, this is not talking about the kinds of disclosures that Goldman did or did not make, which is a separate question. But in broad strokes, one of the things that's a key part of the financial reform is just on derivatives generally, meaning that you take these complex instruments that have been exchanged and the market has grown tremendously, and you put them on exchanges. You cause the trades to be tracked and people to be able to bid on them. There's a lot of debate about that in the Senate, and there's a lot of question about appropriate use of derivatives and inappropriate use. And it's turning out to be one of the big sticking points here in Washington. But one thing that's been very clear is that from the point of view of the White House, they want to see derivatives trading happen in the bright sunlight of the day. And they're pu- pushing very hard on this and making sure that there's no way that in the Senate that particular part gets watered down.
And I want to play something that former President Bill Clinton said about this on television yesterday on ABC This Week. He was responding to the host Jake Tapper's question about whether Treasury Secretary Rubin and Treasury Secretary Summers gave Clinton bad advice on derivatives back when he was in office.
On derivatives, yeah, I think they were wrong, and I think I was wrong to take it. Because the argument on derivatives was that these things are expensive and sophisticated, and only a handful of investors will buy them. And they don't need any extra protection and any extra transparency. The money they're putting up guarantees them transparency. And the flaw in that argument was that, first of all, sometimes people with a lot of money make stupid decisions and make it without transparency. And secondly, the most important flaw was, even if less than 1% of the total investment community is involved in derivatives exchanges, so much money was involved that if they went bad, they could affect 100% of the investments and indeed 100% of the citizens in countries, not investors.
So, Robin, that is quite a statement for a former president to make. Blame me, blame both of my Treasury secretaries, and by the way, one of them, Larry Summers, is still in the position of advising a Democratic president today.
Right, and I imagine Robert Rubin cringing. Robert Rubin, if you go back and look at some of the magazine covers of 95, 96, 97, was this economic hero, was a golden child from Goldman Sachs who came out and saved Mexico and was running triage when some of the emerging economies were collapsing in 97 and 98. But what's striking is, as chairman, as non-executive chairman of Citigroup, which had a lot of its exposure to these exotic and toxic securities, he had to fess up on his way out and say that I frankly didn't know, I believe, what a CDO squared was. And I think it illustrates to what extent, the younger, the kind of the wunderkinder on Wall Street are in charge of these instruments. We saw certainly in the case of Goldman Sachs, the guy was, I think, 28 years old at the time who helped structure this deal.
And the end of what President Clinton said in that clip, Vaughn, is maybe the most important part, because while we may be getting our heads around this thing, probably most Americans are thinking, I never heard of John Paulson. He's not Henry Paulson. I never heard of ACA. I never heard of this German bank that's involved. I was buying homes, and maybe my home went bust, but I certainly wasn't buying CDOs. So what's the relevance to me? But President Clinton in that clip said, even if less than 1% of the total investment community is involved in derivative exchanges, so much money was involved that if they went bad, they could affect 100% of the investments and indeed 100% of the citizens in countries, not investors. Wow.
Well, and that's precisely what we've seen in the last year and a half, 2 years with the financial meltdown, is that everybody's investments have been affected by this. And I actually think it's very important for someone, you know, with the heft and weight of President Clinton to come out and make that clear to the public. And what has been happening in Washington is that you start to see policymakers who also don't understand what a CDO squared is, like Robin was saying, having very little patience for the idea that they're sophisticated and that people will make money off of them. And they also, as I think is clear from previous experience, it's not something that just a few investors will buy, but a lot of investors will be affected by it. And that's where you start to see this interesting intersect between Wall Street and Main Street, which is a very common thing here in Washington, that it affects everybody, even though 99% of the population doesn't know what a derivative is.
Well, Vaughn, you talk about this intersection. I think it's so important to point out that if you were to listen to Goldman Sachs, if Goldman Sachs was a human being and you were sitting at a bar with Goldman Sachs and you put a couple of beers into Goldman Sachs and the id were to suddenly pipe up and talk, this is what America wanted. This is talking to that intersection of Wall Street and Main Street. So much of that subprime froth of the teaser rate mortgages, of the no rate, of the Alt-A. I mean, I don't even know what these things were called ultimately. These things were enabled by the derivatives market. And the likes of Goldman Sachs, the likes of Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, creating an institutional investor appetite for all of these mortgages chopped up in billions of little pieces into such fine luncheon meat and head cheese. And they made people realize that these two could happen, that this was a holy great synergy, that Main Street wanted something and institutional investors wanted something and Goldman Sachs pocketed something in the interim.
So the hunger for derivatives like this and the faith in derivatives like this ultimately brought the insanity down to a much more retail level. I mean, if we think about banks like WaMu encouraging people to take mortgages that old-fashioned financial common sense would have said they couldn't afford or were too risky, that trickled down.
Bingo, diffusion of responsibility, because the mortgage originator, the community bank, whoever, up to WaMu could just ship that off. Put it in sort of a tranche. It's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And that shows the relationship of...
And WaMu then doesn't have any risk of the actual homeowner defaulting they've already sold
right,
the mortgage.
As opposed to most people are still thinking, what, Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life and you're a community banker who knows everybody by face? No, it's absolutely faceless and nameless now.
And so, Dawn, does the financial reform bill before Congress deal with that? Does it make it harder for a bank to sell a mortgage, and who knows what the next scandal will be and what product we're not thinking about today, but does at least make it illegal for a bank to sell off a mortgage or put some kind of barrier up that would actually encourage those letting mortgages to actually take the homeowner's financial situation into accurate account?
It doesn't make it illegal by any stretch. I mean, there's a bunch of checks put in place in the bill, and probably the one that's the most egregious to Wall Street is a concept requiring banks to retain some percentage of, you know, the securities that they are selling, so they can have what they call so-called skin in the game. And this is widely opposed by the industry, but it's being pushed very hard by the administration because they think that banks will make more responsible decisions about how they're going to sell their products if they also have some risks that they're taking on at the same time. There are a lot of arguments within the industry, and I understand them, that this is more of a political fix than it is an actual fix in trying to make sure they make responsible decisions. But this is a game that's being played out on the political front, in part, you know, because we've got this intersection of the people who want. They want to be able to invest into bank money, and they want smart people on Wall Street to come up with ways to do that. But they also want to know how it works, and they want to be ensured that the people who are selling them aren't going to be taking risks that they're not prepared for. And the bill does try to put some stops in place for the industry to do that, but it does so kind of in a piecemeal fashion. It really doesn't make it illegal for you to package and sell products, and I don't think anyone would say that is appropriate. Although certainly there are probably some in the public who would ask for that. So it becomes a very difficult communication problem to try and understand what the Senate is actually talking about doing, and then, you know, for people when they eventually pass legislation to realize that the industry is still going to function largely as it has in the past.
We'll continue in a minute with Fawn Johnson from The Wall Street Journal and Robin Farzad from Business Week as we talk about the fraud charges against Goldman and the relevance to the Senate bank reform debate taking place this week. 212-433-WNYC or post your comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Stay with us.
The bill creates bailout funds, authorizes bailouts, allows for backdoor bailouts from the FDIC, Treasury, and the Fed, and even expands the scope of future bailouts.
So says Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, speaking on the Senate floor last week. But President Obama went hard after him in his Saturday radio address in support of the bank reform bill.
Just the other day, in fact, the leader of the Senate Republicans and the chair of the Republican Senate Campaign Committee met with 24 top Wall Street executives to talk about how to block progress on this issue. Lo and behold, when he returned to Washington, the Senate Republican leader came out against common sense reforms that we've proposed. In doing so, he made the cynical and deceptive assertion that reform would somehow enable future bailouts, when he knows that it would do exactly the opposite.
So we'll try to unpack the bank reform bill a little bit and keep talking about the Goldman Sachs civil fraud charge with Robin Farzad, senior writer from Business Week, Fawn Johnson, Wall Street Journal reporter, and Anthony Manhattan in Manhattan, a securities lawyer, calling in. Anthony, thanks so much.
My comment, Brian, essentially is that the first commandment of securities law, going back to the 30s when it was passed, is full disclosure. And apparently this particular instrument, and I think the name was Abacus or something like that, was designed by Goldman so that their client, the billionaire whose name escapes me, could sell it short. In other words, he could sell it betting that everyone was going to lose. And he specifically picked out particular mortgages and had them bunched together that he knew were going to fail based upon the fact that the mortgage, or the specific bunching of mortgages, was selling at no, putting nothing down on the mortgage, and that it had an escalation clause in it. After 2 years, the interest rate would go up.
But, Anthony, how much disclosure, in your experience as a securities lawyer, is required? Because part of Goldman's defense, as I understand it, is that they say, well, we really never disclose who's on the other side of a trade, as a matter of course, and that they never represented to the people that they were selling to or doing business with on this that the billionaire you referred to, John Paulson, was going to sell. They never represented that he was going to bet long as opposed to bet short. So what disclosure would have really been required, in your opinion?
The full disclosure is the fact that they're designing a security to fail. They designed it so that the underlying mortgages they knew were almost guaranteed to fail.
Anthony, thank you. And Fawn, I think Goldman would dispute that too, because from what I've read anyway, Goldman also bet on these portfolios and they lost money. So to say that they knew they were designing something to fail and selling it as something that was designed to succeed, maybe it's not that simple?
It's definitely not that simple, and certainly the fact that Goldman lost some money on this investment is going to be a key part of their defense. I think what the caller has hit on is an interesting point here in this entire case, is that what the SEC is really looking for, it's a case about disclosure, which is why we haven't seen Mr. Paulson being charged as of yet. But the lawyers who I've been speaking with who've been looking at this case have noted that the really interesting part of this case is going to come when the SEC starts looking into all of the transactions through the discovery process, which they can do as a part of their lawsuit, right? That means that we're actually going to find out, in theory, what kinds of role Mr. Paulson actually played. Did he actually select mortgage securities in areas that were failing, that were setting it up to fail, as it were, or did he play a minimal role? So these are the things that I think part of the reason why this case will be so important is because right now, Goldman is saying they don't need to tell these things. Of course, we would never disclose them. But as they move through the court process, the regulator will actually get a chance to look at all of the specifics of this information, and then can make a call and say this person did in fact or did not play a really big role, and did or did not. Bet against the instrument that it was set up to fail. And so we don't actually know the specifics, but we probably will learn them if this case continues.
And Robin, in your cover story in Business Week on Goldman, which was just before the SEC story or charge came out, Harvey Schwartz, who works for Global Securities at Goldman, is quoted saying the very notion of Goldman Sachs betting against its own clients, quote, reveals a fundamental misunderstanding of Goldman's reason to exist. Can you explain his logic there and why you might be skeptical of it if you are?
Yeah, Goldman kept coming back to its central argument is that we are a market maker. We set up both sides of the trade. If a client, in this case John Paulson, which they wouldn't disclose, comes to us and say, I have this idea, I want to go super short the mortgage market, this whole housing thing is getting rather draggy, Goldman, can you help me out? Because there's no ETF I could buy. There's no thing that's available over the counter. Can you go out there and become my counterparty to the trade? And Goldman Sachs will be, okay, I'll be the long side of the trade. You'll be the short side of the trade. But I simultaneously have to go and insure myself with AIG, which AIG, Goldman is alleging in this case, was all too happy to write these insurance contracts. They thought it was easy money. And I think that's what gets at the that's what hits their argument here, that the very notion that we would bet against our clients, it kind of falls on deaf ears, because it's one thing for Goldman Sachs to go up against AIG, which at the time, you know, in its hale and heartiest, was a AAA rated multinational, very respected insurer. It's another thing, though, when AIG fails and transitively the counterparty to these deals becomes the taxpayer, and you have something like this come out under some sunlight. Suddenly this has tons of public opinion momentum to it, and it's like, well, we enabled a super hedge fund short trade and Goldman Sachs' trade on this.
But it still sounds to me, from what you're saying, like it would be business as usual for Goldman to sort of take both sides of a complicated trade, rather than there was some unique effort to defraud somebody about what Goldman's actual
position
was.
And that's what they're saying. They're saying if we were as Dr. Evil as it's being alleged that we were, we would have made a ton more money than we did in 2008. And in fact, it's been alleged that they only made, I think, $15 million on this one transaction, which is chump change.
Fanny in Manhattan, another securities lawyer. Fanny, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
So I used to work on these deals, not the one that's at issue in this particular securities litigation, but some other abacus deals, not for Goldman, but for other parties. And the bottom line is that I was pretty junior then, but these deals were, like, insanely complicated, even for the lawyer. I mean, they were very different, it seemed, from a regular securities deal and even a regular securitization. Because it was synthetic, we, the lawyers, we never did any due diligence on the underlying mortgages or mortgage bonds or mortgage securities, and we never had it. I mean, I don't know about the investors who were admittedly sophisticated investors. I don't know that they had the ability or even they tried to do proper due diligence on these securities. And in the end, I always had the impression when I worked on these deals that there were maybe a couple of people who kind of, like, set it up and understood it, but most of us who were, like, doing them just went along and did whatever we needed to do, you know. Lawyers write lots of disclosures. I mean, these deals have pages and pages, sheets of risk factors.
So is your point, Fanny, that these deals are not too big to fail but too complicated to exist?
I think so. I mean, I do think that they were, and I think that it was some kind of, like, piling on. Maybe there were no, you know, because of the low interest rates, whatever, there were no alternative investments that were seemed good enough for these people who ended up investing. But, I mean, they were promised pretty good interest rates, and I suppose the rating agencies, of course, we talked about that, or you talked about that before. I mean, the high ratings of these investments, you know, made them seem appealing. But, I mean, if I was kind of junior and as a common sense person, I mean, I didn't get the whole thing, I suppose. I worked on them. But it just felt so weird. I mean, for me, I always had the impression that it took the making money out of thin air to a whole new level.
Fanny, thank you. Do you think that was a common feeling, Fawn, even among people who worked in the business like she did?
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the problem that I think people are trying to address now. And the interesting thing about Fanny's comment, I think, is that because something is synthesized, meaning it's one or two steps beyond what you're actually investigating or what you're actually investing in, it means that you're looking at, you know, one step below if you're doing any kind of due diligence at all, but you don't need to drill all the way down to the bottom, which is what started this whole crisis to begin with. So what you have is you have a regulator coming forward and making a big charge against a big company on something that nobody really understands. And I think partly the goal to get it out into the public is to have a giant education for the country about how the markets have been working and what happened over the last couple of years. But the other thing that they're doing is they're sending a big fat warning to the industry saying you better be careful about what you're marketing and talking about what you're selling, because we're going to come back and we're going to look at what you're saying. And you know, just based on the SEC's own authority that it has now, it can get a lot of information about that. And, you know, they need to come out strong because they need to look like they're a tough regulator. But I think that it also will help help the overall goal of making sure that the industry is paying attention to some of this stuff and realizing at some point somebody might need to just check at the very bottom of the product and, you know, see if it's based on something that is actually saleable or if it's just it's going to sink into thin air.
And maybe they'll pay closer attention if they think that they're not going to get bailed out by the taxpayers if they do fail with things like this in the case of companies the size of Goldman and AIG. So before you go, both go, very briefly, Robin, the president is making this his next big campaign-style issue. It may get it, you know, resolved in Congress this week. The Republican assault on the bill revolves around it not ending too big to fail. That's what Mitch McConnell says. This doesn't end too big to fail. This institutionalizes too big to fail. Funny enough, something that critics from the left also say. Does the bill end too big to fail?
No, it doesn't. Too big to fail, unfortunately, is now an even scarier prospect if we look out 10 or 15 years. Again, we have a record low interest rate environment and a hunger for yield, which is going to foment some other bubble somewhere, if not necessarily mortgage securitization. Two, we have banks that we cobbled together. I mean, J.P. Morgan Chase is now J.P. Morgan Chase, WaMu Bear. I think one of the necessary evils of the rolling bailouts of 2008 is that we necessarily had to have national champion banks. So this is by far, to the extent, it's great that we're finally getting our hands around the derivatives issue, at least notionally. But this doesn't even begin to chip at the issues that Wall Street and the broader economy face.
But on the other hand, Fawn, Democrats say Republicans like McConnell are just carrying water for the banks who don't want to be held accountable in any way. And so the argument that this bill leaves in place too big to fail may be true, but it's not why the banks and the Republicans don't want the bill to pass.
That's probably true. And it's important to remember also that when a bill gets to the level that it's at in Congress now, the arguments start to shift a little bit, and it becomes more of a political game and less of a real debate on the substance. I've always said that, especially if you're dealing with something that's actually on the floor of either the Senate or the House, the debate actually becomes quite silly. And I think that what we've seen with Mitch McConnell over the last couple of weeks is a good illustration of that. In the weeks leading up to the last, when the Senate finally came back and started to look at this issue, they were talking about things like derivatives. They were talking about things like a new consumer financial protection agency. These were genuine sticking points among the negotiations. The whole issue of how you resolve a large risky institution had been negotiated, and nobody really agreed that it was the perfect solution, but I think everyone agreed it was a good starting place.
$10 says that within a week we start hearing about Wall Street death panels.
Well, we already have. That's come out of the House with Barney Frank, the chairman of the Financial Services Committee. He claims it's a death panel to Wall Street.
Predicting Wall Street death panels. Robin Farzad, senior writer for Business Week, confirming that they already exist. Fawn Johnson, Wall Street Journal reporter. Thank you both
so
much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brian.